Today, what we're going to cover is all the evil in the world. Revelation 6. I know I said on the sign I was going to start with 13, but we're going to go back and pick up briefly 5 and 6 and whip through all the middle chapters of the book of Revelation and see what John's critique is. Do you want homework? No. You're on vacation. My students get homework during the year. You don't need any homework. But I thought I'd start with a prayer that talks about one of the evils in the world today, which is, I think, landmines, which kill and maim so many innocent people. We haven't done much about this at Holden, but June 22 to 28 has been designated as International Days of Prayer for Victims of Landmines, an ecumenical observance sponsored by the International Campaign to Ban Landmines. Many organizations from many faiths, including Lutheran churches and Lutheran World Relief here. So this is a time to pray for, pray for a ban on landmines production and trade in the world because they claim innocent victims. But anyway, the prayer I want to read was sent in by Archbishop Desmond Tutu last year to the International Campaign to Ban Landmines. And it has a kind of double play on the word arms. Let us pray. Lord, how can I serve you without arms? How can I walk in your way without feet? I was collecting sticks for the fire when I lost my arms. I was taking the goats to water when I lost my feet. I have a head, but my head does not understand why there are landmines in the grazing land, why there is a tripwire across the dusty road to market. Lord, we are all accomplices in the crime of war, which is a lust for power at all costs. The cost is too much for humanity to bear. Lord, give us back our humanity, our Ubuntu. Teach us to serve you without arms. Amen. What we'll see in Revelation 6 through 18 here, is that we are all accomplices in these crimes, which is a lust for power at all costs. This is the crime of Rome that John is critiquing here in the middle chapters of the Apocalypse. And it's a cost that he says is too much for humanity to bear. So we'll hear the cry of the victims of the violence of Rome, the cry which is the cry of victims still everywhere, which is, how long, O Lord? And that's what we'll hear as the seals are being opened, the voices of the victims crying out for justice and for a speedy end. Okay, yesterday we went on the journey with John up into the divine throne room. Again, thinking about this ancient view of the world that has layers that are quite distinct, the layer of heaven up above, of earth in the middle, and then the underworld underneath. And one of the goals of the apocalypse is to get all the evil figures to end up bound and captive and dead in the underworld so that they no longer have power on earth or in heaven. And we're going to see that unfolding here in these middle chapters as well. We talked yesterday about the possibility that some of the songs and liturgies and praising and doxologies that we hear in chapter 4 especially, but all through the book of Revelation, are designed to counter the songs and liturgies and rituals and prayers of the Roman imperial system, which claimed people's liturgical allegiances and which claimed to be God, and which John, with this carefully constructed critique, is saying, no, Caesar is not God, but the one who sits on the throne is God, who is more beautiful and more to be worshipped, more powerful, more majestic than any of Rome's liturgical or ritual trappings that seem to have such claims over us. So why don't I, and I'll apologize in advance, so what we're going to do today is go on this really fast tour through these middle chapters. So I know we've been kind of slowly making our way through three verses at a time. Now we're going to make up for that in a very rapid way today. But let's just look at chapter 5 first, because we only looked at the throne room liturgy in chapter 4. You saw yesterday the magnificence of the carnelians, the jaspers, the emerald rainbow like a sea of glass, all the praising, the crown clanking, the San Diego Zoo, kind of the cacophony of praise songs and sounds, praising God. And so there's been this big buildup in chapter 4, and now it's going to culminate in chapter 5 with the one who's going to be worthy to open these seals. And this is one of the humorous little sections of Revelation. If you don't believe me that John's got a sense of humor and can do parody of Roman imperial worship, you'll see here that he's able to bring surprises into his plot, and does so right here in chapter 5. Would someone read 5? Well, since we're going to be on this fast tour, how about just 5, 1 through 6? You don't have to read fast, but we'll just shorten our sentence.
Then I saw in the right hand of the one seated on the throne a scroll written on the inside and on the back, sealed with 7 seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?" And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep bitterly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its 7 seals."
You want to just read one more verse?
Then I saw between the throne and the 4 living creatures and among the elders a lamb standing as if it had been slaughtered, having 7 horns and 7 eyes, which are the 7 spirits of God sent out into all the earth.
Okay. And he takes the scroll then. So what, you've got this big buildup in chapter 4, which continues in chapter 5 here at the beginning, this mightiness, who is worthy to open the seals on the scroll? Well, no one is worthy. Only God is worthy. You know, we've had all this prostration, proskunesis, all this bowing. Who's going to be worthy? And then we get this, well, don't worry, someone is worthy. The lion of the tribe of Judah is going to come and open those seals. So you think, okay, a lion, good. This is what you'd expect in an apocalypse, is a big, strong lion, you know, coming onto the scene with strong claws and, you know, gnawing open the seals on the scrolls or whatever. And that would be a conventional feature that we find in other apocalypses with lions or bears or scary beasts. But in verse 16, a total twist on that plot line, which is that instead of a lion, you get this little lamb. And it's not even just the word for lamb, it's the diminutive even of lamb. So it's like lambkin or lamb chop or lamb ear. You know, it's even more fluffy and gentle than a lamb. A totally unexpected figure. And this is going to now become the central image of Christ in the apocalypse. This very, he has a fierce mission here, you can see, but it's a very gentle victim figure, this little lambkin who has been slain and who now is the one who's worthy to open the scrolls. And you can see the hymn, then they break out into singing in verse 9. There's a lot of singing that happens through these chapters here, and they sing a new song, "Worthy are you to take the scroll and open its seals, for you were slain and by your blood purchased people for God." It's the economic word there, bought people for God from every tribe and tongue and nation, and made us a kingdom and priest to serve God. Again, the universal priesthood here in verse 10. But this lamb is the one who's going to be worthy to carry out this very important mission of opening the seals. So now, at the end of chapter 5, the same kind of hymns are sung to the lamb, which were sung to God earlier. Worthy are you, to the lamb be praise and glory forever and ever. Amen. Lots of amens in the book of Revelation, more so than other books. Okay, so now the plot thickens, as it were, and we're going to start into the second of the great series of sevens that you find, numbered series in the book of Revelation. Remember, the 7 letters to the 7 churches were numbered, and now we've got 3 sets that are in some ways the most famous ones of Revelation. The seals on the scroll that need to be opened, and then following that, the trumpets that will be blown, and following that, the bowls of wrath that will be poured out on the earth. And each of these sort of unleashes cataclysmic forces over the earth. They're scary sounding, they're strange, they're terrifying, they unleash plagues of various kinds. And don't be intimidated by these seals, trumpets, or bowls. Part of what's going on here with the plagueness of them, as it were, is to invoke memories of the Exodus for us. So some of why they bring hail and fire and brimstone and that kind of stuff and turn waters to blood, that's a common theme in Revelation, is that we've heard that before in the Bible, and it's to bring, call to memory those same kind of events, which were where? In Egypt, right? God's people have been captive before, John is saying. This isn't the first time that an evil power has ruled over us and held us captive. Rather, that happened already in Egypt when God's people were captive to Pharaoh there, and God sent plagues as part of the process of freeing people from Pharaoh's grip. Pharaoh's heart was hardened. We'll see that theme here in Revelation as well. The powers, the more God sends these evils, the more hearts are hardened. But finally, redemption will come, John is saying, just as it came to redeem people out of Egypt. Finally, Pharaoh's grip was loosened, and people were brought through the water into liberation and freedom, and that will happen again. And very deliberate links are being made between the events of Revelation and people's current captivity to Babylon and the captivity in the Exodus, to the point that the most direct link is an actual mention of the Song of Moses as the song that's being sung now by God's people. The Song of the Lamb is the same song as the Song of Moses. Why don't we even take a look at that, if you want to hold your hand here and flip over to chapter 15. Slightly out of order, but we'll back up. You'll see the very deliberate way this linkage to the Exodus is being established. Now, this is the beginning of the bowls sequence, the last of the series of seven, and the most intense. But it starts with a song. If somebody would read 15 verses 2 to 4, you'll see the Song of Moses mentioned there in verse 3. 15, 2 to 4.
And I saw another portent from heaven, great and amazing, seven angels and seven plagues, which are the last, for with them the wrath of God is ended. And I saw what appeared to be a sea of glass mixed with fire, and those who had conquered the beast and its image and the number of its name standing beside the sea of glass with harps of God in their hands. And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb. Great and amazing are your deeds, Lord God the Almighty. Just and true are your ways, King of nations. Lord, who will fear and glorify, who will not fear and glorify your name? For you alone are holy, all nations will come and worship before you, for your judgments have been revealed.
Okay, thanks. Now, if you want to see the, we are not going to look at the Old Testament today, but the Song of Moses is in Exodus 15, and it's a song of liberation. So you can hear echoes of that singing in joy, as you hear now in these songs, God's people singing the Song of the Lamb, and John is establishing those links for us, so that the Sea of Glass here, you know, is similar to the Red Sea, and there's all kinds of links between the various waters. It's interesting, Pablo Ricard, whose commentary on the Apocalypse I've been drawn on, reminds us that a lot of natural disasters, now I know this past year we've been through a great many with tornadoes and the floods in North Dakota and stuff, but he points out that in Latin America and in the Philippines and Indonesia, many of the floods and other disasters that we happen, that are ecological, are also related to human causes and have greed and you know, the complete deforestation of trees upriver from these rivers causing some of the flooding and stuff, and that there are human connections with this. Terry Fredheim, who's taught up here, has an article that's been kind of a landmark with this, with the plagues of the book of Exodus, where he points out that these are ecological signs, you know, fire, hail, blood, but they're intended to point out the human interaction with nature that's also part of the ecological disaster that happens when unjust empires completely enslave not only people but also creation, and that there's causal relationships between what happens to the land and the waters and what happens to people. And some of that we see in the book of Revelation. It's actually one of the things I like about this book, that nature is such a vivid participant in the events of the world, both in salvation and in judgment. In salvation, we'll see tomorrow when we look at the waters, the living waters of life in the New Jerusalem vision, that nature very much participates in salvation. And you see in these middle chapters that nature is part of, is an actor with all the other forces of God in the judgment that is brought upon the earth. It's not in these apocalypses, and this is very typical of all apocalypses, the book of Daniel and the ones that also didn't make it into the Bible, that it's not just the sense that the world is a stage and we are the real actors in the drama and nature sort of functions as props. You know, you need a tree to lean on here, so you lean on a tree. Like sometimes we've seen nature be. And it seems like God doesn't have regard for nature. In the apocalypses, nature fully participates. You've got talking animals and waters and plants and stuff. There's not so much talking that happens in Revelation, although in chapters 15 and 16, the waters get a voice through the angel of the waters and stuff, but there's lots of participation of the forces of nature in apocalyptic books, and it's very important, I think, for us to recover that sense of the participation of creation in the drama of judgment and salvation here. So the Song of the Lamb is the Song of Moses, and that's part of why we see so many plagues in Revelation. Don't be scared by these plagues. I mean, they are scary and awful, but you can interpret these. You can understand them by reading the book of Exodus again and seeing how this is familiar imagery for God's people. And it spells liberation, even though for a moment now it spells judgment. Okay, back to those seals then. If you... you've been holding your fingers patiently in your Bible all this time, right? Back to chapter 6. Let's see what time it is. Holy smokes. The end is near here. Okay, move through these. Okay, so lamb chop or lambkin or whoever is worthy to open the seals, and one by one now he's going to paw them open, however little lamb he gets the seals open. He starts with the first one, and with each of these first four seals, these are the famous four horse riders or horsemen of the apocalypse, who we all know is actually the Notre Dame football team, is that right? How does that work anyway? We're the defensive...
Backfield.
Newt Rockne and three others were the four horse riders of the apocalypse. Okay, because I just saw a reference in the Chicago paper to the possibility of the Bulls team as having that label. Some members, I don't know who the four are, but... I don't know. Anyway, these are famous images. You almost have to know the apocalypse to be able to understand Western art and music anyway, because these figures come up all the time. You know, everybody's, 666 is there everywhere you turn, and to be a literate person, these figures are often invoked. Actually, why don't we even read these four horsemen here? If somebody, why don't we go around, whoever wants to read one of the seals. So somebody read verses 1 and 2, somebody 3 and 4, somebody 5 and 6, etc. And we'll get through the four seals that way. All right, I get a call on people. Carol.
Then I saw the Lamb open one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures call out as with a voice of thunder, "Come." I looked, and there was a white horse. Its rider had a bow. A crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer.
When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature call out, "Come." And out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth, so that people would slaughter one another, and he was given a great sword.
When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature call out, "Come." I looked, and there was a black horse. Its rider held a pair of scales in his hand, and I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a day's pay, and three quarts of barley for a day's pay, but do not damage the olive oil and the wine."
When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature call out, "Come." I looked, and there was a pale green horse. Its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed with him. They were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword, famine, and pestilence, and by the wild animals of the earth.
Okay. So these are the four horses unleashed with the first four seals. It's interesting. I mean, the first, you can see they cover a range of violence here. Peace is taken from the earth, and so there's a recognition of the violence on the earth. And the third seal is an intriguingly specific kind of economic critique. In the middle of all the sort of generality, you know, of pestilence, famine, you know, things that are sort of timeless and terrible, all of a sudden you get this very astute, even kind of pointed description of specific, trading kinds of concerns. A quart of wheat for a day's pay and three quarts of barley for a day's pay, which wasn't enough. I mean, people needed more than that. So this is sort of recognizing that the poor don't have enough to eat. And then this intriguing, but do not harm the olive oil or the wine. Whatever else happens in the economy, don't touch the important cash crops, which are the luxury goods. You know, people might be squeezed out from being able to afford the basic staples, the staff of life, barley and wheat. But don't start planting barley where we've got the vineyards planted, because we need that cash economy. And it's kind of an interesting, fascinating little snippet of John's kind of understanding of part of the evil. In the midst of all this kind of mythic and cosmic evil that he's describing, it's also a critique of the Roman economy, which was squeezing people off the land and was devoting more and more sort of attention to the luxury goods at the expense of regular people. And then I think that explains part of his attention to famine, too, that we hear coming up over and over. People can't buy what they need to eat and drink. They might even be having to pay for water to drink, it appears. That might be part of why he emphasizes so much in the New Jerusalem vision that water is free, without cost, without charge. And then, let's see, I'll just mention the fourth horse's rider's name is Thanatos, or Thanatos, translated here as death, but it also can mean pestilence or plague. So Hades follows him, and they kill with the sword, with famine, and with Thanatos. They are named Thanatos, and they kill with Thanatos, so that it's unfortunate that that second mention of death is translated as pestilence, and you don't see that that's actually the name of the horseman. So these first four horses unleash these terrible things that sort of basically cover the full range of what Rome's evils are, as far as John sees. And then the fifth and sixth seal are the cry of the response of people on earth to this dreadful injustice and violence that's been unleashed here with this imperial system. And this is one of the defining questions of the book of Revelation. I can't say the only defining question, because yesterday I told you the question that defines the book is, whom do you worship? But today there's another question that needs to still be in our ears as we read the world today and read this book and read any kind of situation that we find ourselves in. So would somebody be willing to read the fifth seal, verses 9 through 10?
When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slaughtered for the word of God and for the testimony they had given. They cried out with a loud voice, Sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long will it be before you judge and avenge our blood on the inhabitants of the earth? They were each given a white robe and told to rest a little longer until the number would be complete, both of their fellow servants and of their brothers and sisters, who were soon to be killed as they themselves had been killed.
Okay, thanks. So that question, how long, O Lord, when there's oppression or marginalization or persecution of any kind, that question still rings in our ears from so many countries around the world. How long is this injustice going to continue? And they're told not much longer, but just a little while longer. And that's the sort of tension then that runs through the book of Revelation. We know that the end is near, that God is saying this isn't going to last forever, but it's going to last a little bit longer. And in fact, as the book unfolds, things are going to get worse before they get better. But they're told that their cry is heard, and that cry echoes through the book. The sixth seal is open in verse 12, and this is just kind of stock apocalyptic imagery. I don't know how else to describe it. There's a good chart in this book, in the Prevost book, that shows how the sixth seal is almost the same kind of imagery as you find in the little apocalypse in Mark 13 and in its parallels in Luke and Matthew. You also find this kind of stuff in Daniel or 2 Ezra. Pretty much any apocalypse will have the moon darken and turning to blood, and the sun is, stars falling, that kind of stuff. It sounds like, whoa, but it's standard. It's like if you were going to do Alt A for, just bring in the apocalyptic couple of verses here. That's what you'd find.
An apocalyptic paragraph B.
Yeah, right. We've seen it before. And look at Prevost if you want to see where you've seen it before. It's quite conventional, even though to us it sounds like, wow, and certainly I wouldn't doubt that what there were people who, this spring we had an eclipse on this side and a comet on the other side, in the night sky. It was pretty wonderful. It was the end of March to be able to, have this amazing comet here, which was, spectacular. And then we've got an eclipse of the moon happening the very same night. I mean, wow, we've read all about it in the Bible. I shouldn't make fun of that, but I don't read it like that. I mean, I think we make too much of this if we take it literally. This is metaphorical kind of imagery that was familiar to describe the cataclysmic consequences that happen as part of the unfolding of judgment. And I don't take a literal reading of comets or of this stuff. And I know there are many who do, but I don't. Okay, moving right along, you got six seals open now, and what happens next is not conventional apocalyptic, which is that in each of the three sets now of the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls, between the sixth and the seventh element, there's an interlude of salvation, a very wonderful, comforting interlude of salvation. And you see that especially with the seals, with the whole of chapter 7 is kind of an insert that is not Alt apocalypse, whatever. It's not, put in what you'd expect. This is quite unusual to have this kind of interlude coming up again and again through this book. And what it is, I think, is a way of comforting the people and saying, I know I've just thrown some scary stuff at you, the sun turning to blood and darkening and stuff, but then I'm going to show you this comforting vision and remind you that you are claimed by God, and that the Lamb will be your shepherd and will guide you to streams of living water, and you will hunger and thirst no more, and tears will be wiped away. And it's this vision of the 144,000 standing before the throne of God, waving their palm branches and being comforted by the Lamb. So the seventh element of this series of seven never happens without this kind of, at least a brief little comforting interlude. And in the case of the seals, it's a very long interlude of comfort and salvation. This is the one where we get the song "Behold a Host" from. I mean, this is wonderful imagery here that people do read this chapter for comfort, and don't get fixated on is it really only 144,000? But what do you do when the world has 5 billion people? And I mean, it's not a literal number; it's a big number. That's the key, and it's a perfect number of a multiple of sevens. So that's chapter 7. Okay, we covered that. No, we'll come back to that tomorrow a little bit. But so after this wonderful comforting interlude, then in chapter 8, the Lamb opens the seventh seal. And there's a silence in heaven for half an hour. And then the trumpets start in. So you get the seals open, now you got the trumpets blown. And the same thing, this kind of concern at the beginning of the trumpets for those people who are under the altar, who have been slain, who are crying out, "How long, O Lord?" And their prayers are rising into heaven to mingle with the liturgies and songs and prayers of all the saints who have gone before them. And this is a way, again, remember in the structured universe of Revelation, with heaven up above, earth in the middle, and the underworld underneath, there are moments of interaction between heaven and earth. And one of them here, one of the lovelier ones, is these prayers of the people on earth, which rise up to heaven and are mingled, and God hears those. So it's a way of saying, it's not just action on earth with these trumpets and seals, but God is indeed interacting too. Okay, we're not going to look at all at the trumpets. except to say that they're familiar imagery from the Exodus plagues. It's not all new stuff here. Some of it is new. I mean, there are definitely new paths that John gives to it, but it's familiar stuff. Now, one of the questions with the book of Revelation is, and this isn't a question that I particularly ask, but even if you were to try to do a timetable of the events of the end time, if you wanted to read this book literally and say, this forecasts the events of the future, which I don't think that's the function of the book. And remember, we talked about on the first day with this reading Revelation in light of the genre that it is. John identifies this book as prophecy, and that's prophecy in the Old Testament sense of prophecy, of exhorting and comforting people to be faithful to God. It's not a kind of prediction of the future. If you want that, you go to a fortune teller, or who do you go to? I don't know. But that's not what the biblical understanding of prophecy primarily is to predict the future. So that's why I don't try to figure out the timetables of Revelation, and I would encourage you not to also. People will come to your door with tracts that tell you that that's what the purpose of Revelation is, and just tell them you're not interested. Because I don't think that's what's most interesting about Revelation, or that that's the function. But the thing is, even if you tried to read the imagery literally and figure out a blueprint of the future on the basis of Revelation, there's a divide among those who take it literally. You've got to figure out with these sequences, the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls, are they consecutive? You know, do you do a timeline where, I don't know, for 50 years the seals are open? And this is what David Koresh was trying to do at Waco, you know, and he found himself between the fifth and the sixth seal, and he was laying out a timeline. All right, so do you do the seals first, and then next in consecutive or temporal order, then the events of the trumpets will take place, and then next in temporal order, the events of the bowls? Or are they recapitulating the same events, but just told three times, but with ever heightened intensity? In other words, that the years, supposedly, that are represented by the seals, are then told again with the trumpets in even kind of worse and more intense judgment, and then the same thing with the bowls, it's even more so. And people have parted company over that one. Even literalist interpreters have said, oh, they recapitulate the same thing. Others have had said consecutive. So that's how you end up with different sequences of years and time and stuff. I mean, it's hard. Well, it's not that hard to do a timeline with Revelation. My mom's clipping that she sent me about this guy in Minneapolis that's doing it. People always are doing it. It's just that they don't agree on the timeline because it's so complex. And it's almost as if Revelation is structured to sort of defy attempts to get it laid out as a blueprint. I mean, you really can't. These different sequences are so interlocked with one another that it becomes quite, idiosyncratic the way you want to interpret it as a blueprint. People don't agree. Fundamentalists can't agree among themselves, or millenarianists can't agree among themselves the sequence. And actually, Boyer, in this book, When Time Shall Be No More, has some of these charts visualizing the end. He's got a diagram from John Phillips' 1983 book, Exploring the Future, that looks like this, with different, you know, you got your seals, bowls, trumpets, and then the rapture and various things. One of my students from a fundamentalist denomination gave me a chart last year in my class that lays it out differently. I mean, each interpreter will take his or her, usually his, own spin and have the events, have himself be the turning point if he views himself as a great prophet and everybody else before that was false. And, you know, he'll figure out the end time events and then try to convince you this is the one true way to interpret Revelation. Well, if you take anything from this week, I hope what you'll take is there isn't one true way to interpret Revelation. There's multiple meanings and multiple interpretations, and we can play around with various ways to hear the message of this book. I genuinely believe that the images of Revelation are what scholars call multivalent. If John had just wanted to lay out a blueprint, he could have done that. But he's rather using metaphors and images precisely because they can have multiple meanings and invoke multiple kinds of allusions for us in our thinking. It's visionary, and you can't pin it down to one blueprint or interpretation. That doesn't mean that anything goes, but there are various ways to interpret Revelation within a range of legitimate interpretation.
Clark? Uh-huh. There always been sort of fundamentalist versus non-fundamentalist interpretation of Revelation throughout the hundreds of years since it was written. Has it always been used as a fundamentalist?
Yeah. But I wouldn't say that it's not even that easy to peg people, because where would you put Augustine, for example? Well, he was a more spiritualized reader of it. In a sense, Martin Luther would be cast then as a fundamentalist. The first time Luther read Revelation, he said, "This book is ridiculous. It doesn't preach Christ. You know, avoid it at all costs." And then the second time, unfortunately, this is even more unfortunate that he read it, he figured out that it was the best resource for vilifying your enemies, because you just plug, you know, so all the people you love to hate, you identify them as the different grasshoppers and beasts, and, you know, the Pope is the whore of Babylon and the beast, and I mean, you know, so he took a very kind of literalist take on it when he wanted to use it to critique others. So it's sort of hard to decide who's fundamentalist and who's not, but yeah, it's always been a very handy way to plug in. Babylon can be Russia, or it can be United States, depending on whether you're left wing or right wing. I mean, you just take whoever you dislike and you have them be the beast, and it works great, and it serves you well.
Uh-huh. Is the kind of the aspect also that the people who are the oppressed people, when they read it, they kind of get it? But if a Roman soldier read it, he wouldn't get it. He would.
Yes. I think the first part especially is true, that when oppressed people would read it, they would get it, because they hear these cries as their own. I mean, I think we really can hear a lot and learn a lot from reading it through the lens of oppressed people. The second part is true, but not in the sense of it being a secret code or something that can't be cracked by the Roman censors. I think apocalypses were common enough in the ancient world. Romans knew them, even though they were most familiar in the Jewish world. There are Greco-Roman apocalypses as well, so it wouldn't have been like code language for them. But it's, you know, it's the question of, can rich, comfortably well-off people, can oppressors ever get what the underclass sees more vividly? I mean, it's like you look around anywhere, let's say, Holden, for example, and you'll say, if you're in power, you might say, there's no cliques here, you know, there are no outsiders, everyone's welcome. Well, underclass people always know more about how, you know, exclusion works. So in that sense, I think it's definitely more readable from the perspective of marginalized peoples. But it's not that it's a secret code that can't be cracked by the Romans. They could read apocalypses too if they are willing to hear themselves being critiqued. It's not that secret of a language, I guess I would say.
Uh-huh. Hasn't anyone come up with a computer program that resolves it all yet?
Probably, but I'm sure they wouldn't agree. I mean, you know, a lot of people, I'm sure. I don't have any. I'm not very good at computers. It's the mark of the beast. So that's just one possible interpretation. Now, I ask for the others of you that like computers. Moving right along here. Oh my gosh, the end is near. Well, since this session was billed yesterday as the beast, the baby, and the bride, we're going to just take a quick look at the baby chapter, which is chapter 12. I realize it doesn't matter whether it's Babylon or the baby. They're all in here. Everyone's in Revelation. In chapter 12, it's a turning point in the book. It's a very mythic kind of chapter. You find this woman clothed with the sun, and she's with child. She's pregnant, and she's crying out in the pangs of childbirth. This also is familiar apocalyptic imagery, the analogy to childbirth. And there's this dragon up in heaven chasing her around. This chapter takes place up here at this level. We've gone back up to heaven to see what's happening. She's being chased around up there because this dragon wants to eat her child. So this is the baby, just to let you know. And what happens in chapter 12 is that the fight breaks out in heaven, and the dragon gets thrown out of heaven. The goal of the apocalypse is to get the dragon down into the abyss and tied up, bound forever and dead, basically, never again to rule. And so in chapter 12, he gets halfway there. He's a battle wages in heaven, and he gets thrown down to earth. But what that means, he's halfway to the abyss, but now things are going to get even worse on earth, because now he's mad, and he can, you know, roam around on earth doing all his evil on earth. So chapter 12 is that turning point in the plot here. The dragon's trying to eat the child, and he doesn't succeed, but he gets thrown out, and now he's on earth, and he's mad. So chapter 13 then describes his effects. He's got his lackeys, the beasts, that do his evil work, and chapter 13 lays them out, the first beast and the second beast. And I want to just have us read some about the second beast here, because this is a rather telling political or religious critique of what Rome is doing. And then we're going to look at chapters 17 and 18, which is a more economic critique. John is an astute reader of his culture, and he sees Rome as enslaving people sort of at every level. They are captive to this awful empire or realm, and he diagnoses it in terms of beasts and whores and the claim that these evil figures have over people. And he's going to do what an apocalypse does, which is uncover this and reveal the illusion that's really at work here with this evil. So would someone read about the second beast here, chapter 13, 11 through, 18.
Then I saw another beast that rose out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast on its behalf, and it makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound had been healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from the heavens to earth in the sight of all. And by the signs that it is allowed to perform on behalf of the beast, it deceives the inhabitants of the earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that had been wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast could even speak and cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell who does not have the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let anyone with understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a person. Its number is 666.
Well, this this first part here is what I call the Wizard of Oz section of the Book of Revelation, which is, you know, remember when Dorothy and her companions first got to Oz, and they were terrified of that image of Oz that had, doesn't he have smoke coming out of his nostrils, and there are thunder and peals of great noise and stuff, and they're terrified. This is a terrifying image that seems to be all-powerful and all-controlling. And what John is doing here is playing the role of Toto, of pulling back the curtain there and exposing, this isn't a scary, you know, all-powerful image of Oz. This is levers and smoke, you know, and there's really just this little man using technology to cause all these terrible things to happen. Boy, I've never said that before. John plays the role of Toto. But, you know,
notes.
They did. Pardon me?
With a computer note.
Yeah, really. We know from archaeological evidence that they did have the technology to be able to cause smoke and things to come out. They would have hollow statues, and they could make this kind of thing happen, very much like the Wizard of Oz, and could project sound to make a statue seem very all-powerful. And that clearly must have been the case in one of the towns that John is writing to, where the image seems so scary, and he's basically saying, don't worry, it's just it's just a bunch of levers and smoke
and
stuff.
Did Delphi have something like that? I mean, Delphi had the...
Mm-hmm. Well, most places did, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, you go to almost any archaeological site, and you'll see kind of secret passage at the oracles, Delphi, Claros, people could go up under the statue and they'd go there to, you know, other people would visit to get it. Absolutely. It wasn't that difficult. And besides, they were technologically very good. So anyway, people are apparently prostrating. Remember, worship is not just worship in our sort of narrow sense, perhaps, but it's this whole idea of prostration or giving allegiance to something or someone. And people are giving their allegiance to this empire in the form of the statue that represents probably Nero, the very evil emperor of the mid-first century who had killed a lot of people, not just Christians, but anybody he didn't like, he killed. And they're scared. And what John is saying here is that is don't be frightened of this beast, of this figure of Nero. There was this idea that Nero had died, but not really, that he had just gone off somewhere, he'd been wounded, but he was going to come back. So in popular culture of the ancient world, you expected possibly a return of Nero, the evil emperor. And his number here is 666. And this, of course, is the great mythic enigma of the Book of Revelation here. Probably referring to Nero. And Prevost's book is very good here at laying out how in Greek and in Latin, you don't have numbers. You just have letters. It's hard to imagine a typewriter with no numbers, but they didn't. So they used letters to represent numbers. And so he shows you how the number 666 actually spells out or can be made to spell out Nero. People make it spell out. Hal Lindsey could make it spell something else. And you can make it spell whatever you want to. Just have letters represent numbers and vice versa, and you can get it to put your brother's name or whatever, you know. But most likely it's Nero, and you can use his chart in here to see how the letters in Greek do that. The thing that I find kind of funny is, do you have a footnote there at the end of verse 18? This is one of the really, yeah. You know, we've gotten so worked up about this 666 idea, but actually there are manuscripts that are pretty good that call the number 666, rather than 666. So, you know, the manuscripts don't even agree on what this number is. You know, he says in this very solemn way, let everyone reckon this number. It's the number of a person. And then it's like, well, is it agent 99 or is it agent 666? You know, I mean, is it 616666? Who is it? And of course, this is one of the aspects of Revelation that has been most picked up on in popular culture. And Boyer's book is really funny here on bringing in some of these. He's got pictures and descriptions of some of the many things that 666 has been interpreted as. I'll just read a little bit here. No prophecy writer devoted more attention to these matters than Mary Stuart Relfe. I don't even know how to pronounce her name, R-E-L-F-E, a native of Montgomery, Alabama, and real estate developer whose book, When Your Money Fails, The 666 System, published in 1981, sold more than 600,000 copies. 666,000. And then she followed it up the following year with a book called The New Money System 666, where she zeroed in on the uniform product code, the basic juggernaut in the cashless society. She spared nothing in her effort to uncloak the conspiracy and expose the evils of this system in light of Bible prophecy. And what she realized is that you cannot buy and sell without the mark of the beast, the universal product code found even on our Bibles, the mark of the beast. And, what's interesting is, well, it sounds ridiculous. I hope it sounds ridiculous. But what she picks up on is, I mean, I think there is an economic dimension to the critique that John is giving us here, which is that in the Roman economy, they certainly didn't have the universal product code, but there was something all-encompassing about that economy as well, that if you didn't have money, you couldn't be a part of anything. And you couldn't participate in life as they knew it. I mean, the market economy was so dominant and so all-powerful, just as Ricard points out that it is today in the world, and the marginalized people are getting more and more excluded from our world, especially in the third world. You know, so even if we don't agree with Ralph, or however you say your name, that it's this, you know, barcode, you know, it has possibly an insightful element in seeing that it is something economic related to our absolute dependence on a universal economic system without which nothing functions and no one can participate. But anyway, Boyer's got a lot more about this. I mean, he has a whole chapter called Antichrist 666 and the Mark of the Beast that gives a very lovely little sort of history of all these famous names, the radio preacher, Jack Van Impe, and others who, you know, and you'll hear all the interpretations of this that you'll want from the history of American popular culture, which is kind of fun.
Is he a Seventh-day Adventist?
Boyer? No. Impe? I don't even know. I can't remember. I mean, I read these and then I think, oh, I should be able to keep these straight, and they all kind of, you know, blend together, I'm sorry to say, in my thinking. Boyer teaches at the University of Wisconsin, and he's a major speaker now, often at conferences on this kind of stuff as we approach the millennium. Okay, moving right along, skipping over the bowls now. We've already started them with chapter 15. So in chapter 13, it's basically a critique. What we saw there was a critique, a political and economic ideological critique of those who worship the beast and of the worship that he claims and of the economic stranglehold that he's got on people. What is added to this critique in chapters 17 and 18 is a recognition of the seductive dimensions of this system, that it's not some hideous, abhorrent-looking system that everyone recognizes as evil, but rather many people have found this system attractive and have been seduced by it. And I think it's to critique that element, that it's for that reason that he portrays the empire in chapter 17 as a harlot or as a prostitute, to remind us that it's got a seductive kind of charm about it, that even though she's an ugly prostitute, she is offering something that people seem to want, which is this golden cup of abominations that people seem eager to partake of. I mean, she or it, and I'm gonna call it an it, because one of the things that I find most problematic about the apocalypse is the way it portrays or personifies evil as women. And so that I agree, and I think it's very important that we recognize the seductive power of the claims of Rome on us, but it doesn't mean that we have to portray it as a seductress and label it as feminine. And hate her for that trait, because I think that's rather incidental to the way John really wants to unleash his critique. I don't think sex is what he's most concerned about. I think he's concerned most about the claims of Rome, and he's portraying them as a seductress because that is a very effective way to show the allure or the appeal of this system that apparently was sucking in many people. Christians as well as non-Christians. I mean, the whole world has apparently participated in this system, and John wants us to come out of that. He's going to call us out of the spider web of this seductive empire and call us to not participate, but people have apparently fallen for it, and he sees that it's an alluring, appealing system. So that's chapter 17, is the portrait of Rome as a seductress who's enticing people into the web or into this. In chapter 18, however, it's clear that this harlot or seductress is actually a city or an empire. I mean, at the very end of 17, she's in chapter 17, verse 18, we are specifically told, "The woman that you saw is the great city, which has dominion over the kings of the earth." It's an empire or a city. It's not primarily a woman. Chapter 18 has a couple really important elements that I just want to try to get to here before the bell rings. First of all, it shifts now into a major economic critique, threefold, a critique of the kings of the earth and their economy, a critique of the merchants of the earth and their economy, and a critique of the shipbuilders, shipfarers, sea traders, John obviously had studied and watched the ships coming into port every day in Ephesus. He saw that the Roman economy was totally dependent on long distance commercial trade, and he saw what these ships were bringing, and he was appalled by it. And we find in chapter 18 a very detailed description and critique of that, culminating in the central one of these three vignettes, the merchants who are weeping and mourning as Babylon is destroyed. And if you look at verses 12 through 13, you see what the cargo is that their ships are carrying. Cargo of gold, silver, jewels, pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, scarlet, scented wood, ivory, all these luxury goods. And what I want to point out at the very end of verse 13, he sees also that the ships are bringing slaves, human souls, he says. And he critiques that. And this is one of the few places in the New Testament, if any, that you see a critique of slavery. And I think as Christians, we really need this. I mean, for too many centuries, Christians were reading to their slaves the passages from Ephesians, mm-hmm. Slaves, be obedient to your masters, and others, where it seemed that in the letter to Philemon, it seems that perhaps Paul sent back an escaped slave to his master. Well, that's terrible. And it seems that in Ephesians, other Christians are encouraging slaves to be obedient. But John isn't like that. He's naming the evil of slave trade, and he's one of the authors that we really need to hear on this in his sweeping critique of the economy. Very important here. Classic scholars tell us that, in fact, Revelation 18 is the single most pointed critique of the ancient world, of Rome, ever written by any ancient author. No one else, pagan or Christian, had the guts to write what John writes here in terms of unmasking the evils of this empire. No one else critiqued it this sharply or pointedly. And why don't we just look at the call to come out of this, which we find in Revelation 18, verses 4 to 6. What John is doing is saying, if you've been seduced by Rome and this evil empire, come out now. Don't participate in these terrible sins. Divest yourself somehow. So if someone would read verses 4 to 6. You'll see that call.
And then I heard another voice from the heavens saying, come out of her, my people, so that you do not take part in her sins, and so that you do not share in her plagues. For her sins have heaped high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Render her as she herself is rendered, and repay her double for her deeds. Mix a double drop for her in the cup that she has mixed.
Okay, so, and I should say that come out of her, it's really hard as a translator to know how to translate this. I would translate it rather as come out of it, because I don't think she's so much a woman as a city. But it's the fact that in English we don't have gendered nouns like most other languages of the world. In French it's like le livre, but this is a masculine thing, and but it's a feminine chair, la chaise. Greek is like that too, where it's sort of arbitrary what nouns are masculine or feminine. But then this chair in French or Greek would be called she. Get up from her, oh my people. Well, we don't think of this as a she. It's like that. So when you're translating to English, do you translate Babylon as a she or as an it? That's always a dilemma. So I just want to point that out, that it's gendered nouns. And the noun for city in Greek, as in most languages, is feminine, in Hebrew as well. So cities are feminine, but that doesn't make them women necessarily. So come out of it. But anyway, you see here the plea to come out and divest yourself. And as you're coming out of this economy, give back what she's given you. This cup of wrath, which is familiar from the book of Jeremiah, from the Old Testament prophets, that gets passed around from one nation to another. Give back the cup of wrath to Babylon. Don't bring any of the trappings of Rome with you as you somehow come out of participating in this realm. Get out of that web while you can, lest its plagues come upon you, and divest yourself of everything, and don't participate in this evil economy, this evil political system, this evil empire. Now, of course, we're totally out of time. I would like to ask you, what does that mean to come out? How do we construct a countercultural church? Do we cease to deal with anything that has the universal product code on it? In which case, that means not participate. No more books, no more anything. Do you tear up your credit cards? I mean, what exactly does it mean to come out? It's obviously metaphorical in Revelation, and the question was even for John's hearers, what did it mean? Were they supposed to not trade anymore with the coins of the empire, which had the image of the emperor on it? What does it mean to come out? I mean, I think, but we all need to grapple with this question of how God calls us out of participating in something that has seduced us, and what it means then to not be a participant in perpetuating this evil that is what's being critiqued.
Barbara, I always kind of like the interpretation, and does it fit with what you are studying now and sharing with us, that Domitian really thought of himself as a god. He was the emperor that was one of those that got to the point where he wanted to be looked at as a god, and that the people had to line up actually and get a mark on them somehow that showed that, and they had to say, Domitian is Lord. So that a Christian might have to face that decision, because if you didn't have that mark, then you couldn't participate in the buying and the selling and the economy, so that would be coming out by making that decision. Is that?
Yeah, well, there's a couple problems with that. I mean, I think that holds. I guess I would say the first problem is, does that let us off the hook then? Because we can say, well, fortunately, we don't have to worship Bill Clinton like that. You know, so I guess we don't have any problems like these. I mean, we're not being persecuted for our faith, thank God. We can still fly our American flags in our churches, and, you know. So does that let us off the hook? The other problem with that would be, historically, while we know that was the case two emperors later under Trajan, that there was some forcing Christians to worship Trajan, it seemed to be rather scattered and not very widespread, and there's no evidence of that during Domitian. So I find it actually, if it was an out-and-out persecution like that, I find it more apropos to our time, that it might have been more subtle marginalization, and then how does that speak to us? So I guess, yes, I think it's really important, and that indeed that exact scenario happened in the time of Trajan. We don't know that it didn't happen with Domitian, we just don't have the documents that show it. And the only reason we've got it with Trajan is because his buddy Pliny wrote him so many letters that we can see exactly what happened. We don't have a Pliny who was like Domitian's companion to write him letters that got preserved. But if that is the case or if it isn't the case, the question is, obviously we don't have that exact same scenario, but what is the call to us to come out? And that's, I guess, the question we'll have to discuss over our coffee break. I'm still holding out for that poppy seed cake. So. We have to divest. We want to eat our cake first. So. Thanks, everybody. Tomorrow, I'll leave more time for discussion. Sorry.